Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to All of It. I'm Nancy Giles, in for Allison Stewart. Thanks so much for joining me today. When air traffic controllers decided to strike in 1981 to protest poor working conditions and a lack of updated technology, then-President Ronald Reagan decided to take a firm stand. Rather than cooperate with strikers, he fired over 11,000 air traffic controllers, among them the father of Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Gregory Pardlow, Gregory Pardlow Sr. In his moving and thought-provoking book, Air Traffic, A Memoir of Ambition and Manhood in America, Greg recounts the profound impact his father's participation in the strike and subsequent firing had on his own life. Part memoir, part essay collection, Greg's work is a profound meditation on patrimony, addiction, class, and what it means to be an ambitious Black man in America. Air Traffic is now available to purchase in paperback, and Greg is with us here right now. Greg, welcome to All of It.
Hi, Nancy. Thanks. Thank you.
You know, what's funny is I remember when the air traffic controllers were fired, and I'm wondering it seems very harsh, and I'm wondering, how old were you when that happened?
I was 12.
What is your memory about the actual strike, the firing, and just to start us off, what do you remember about that?
Well, I remember the whole period leading up to the strike, right? So they were all preparing. The union was preparing. My father was a union organizer. He was a leader in the union. And I remember going to the local where all the men were gathering and talking about what they were going to do and whether or not they would have to strike. And we didn't actually think, we, and I say we because I felt very much a part of the group, right? I identified with them.
Sure.
And we didn't actually think we would have to go on strike because we were such, I keep saying we now, they were such an essential.
You can say we.
Thank you. Thanks. They were such an essential service to the nation. And
we're reminded of that because of what happened when,
exactly,
when the government went on strike and air traffic
was
having, yes, yes, it just happened again.
Yeah, yeah. So, so it just seemed absurd that they would actually be pushed to the point of having to go on strike. And then it was, of course, the great surprise then when they actually did say, okay, well, you've left us with no choice. Dear government, and here we are. And I was on the picket line with my dad that morning, and we discovered later on that day, or at some point while we were striking, the president had appeared in the Rose Garden and announced that the strikers were criminals now because it was an illegal strike, right? Workers, government employees, are not allowed to strike legally, air traffic controllers being among them.
Right.
So now they were elite. They were criminals.
Criminals.
And they were forfeiting their jobs, I think was the quote. And so it just, the stakes just kept raising, mounting and mounting. And it was just, it was confusing to me as a child, but thrilling at the same time because I really did not have a sense of what the stakes were, right? What the end game could be. And then, of course, in the years following that, to back up, immediately following, I watched my father debate whether or not to go back to work, right? So Reagan gives him this ultimatum, you can either go back or you forfeit your jobs.
Right.
And so what is my father, he had two kids at that time, a newborn, my brother had just been born, and a mortgage, and, right, so what does a young man do? And it was very romantic to me. I admired my dad for sticking with the men, the mm-hmm. men and women, the rank and file, right? And it just, that was really formative for my sense of politics and my sense of community.
Ethics.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. But as I say, in the years following that, the price became the price that my father paid and the price that we as a family ultimately came to pay became very apparent as time went on. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. And isn't it true that once the firings happened, were those air traffic controllers not allowed to rejoin the union? I mean, they were like banned for life.
They were banned from I mean, and it's such a specialized job. It's not like you can take your skills and just go somewhere else. Well, I mean, I guess there was the alternative of moving to Canada, or, you know, my father didn't speak any other languages, so I think Kuwait was another possibility.
Can you imagine?
Exactly, right.
So that really had a profound change on the whole family dynamic. I mean, you're telling, getting to your background, your parents were quite young when you were born. Can you talk a little bit about that? What was going on before the strike happened?
Yeah, so my father was, he was 19 and my mother was 21, and they were student activists. My father led the Black Student Union at Germantown High School.
Right on.
Yeah, and they had to, they eloped to get married, very much against the wishes of their parents. And they bought a little house. I don't know how my father had a couple of jobs and bought a little house in North Philly. And so I was born, and eventually my grandfather, my mother's father, who worked for the FAA, I guess his heart softened, and he helped my father get a job with the FAA. And that's how my dad got into air traffic control.
That was his connection to that profession.
That was the connection,
You kind of write, there's kind of a sense in your writing that you felt like your father might have been a little bit resentful toward you even kind of showing up on the scene, since he and your mom were so young.
Yeah.
How did you feel that?
Well, so he had, and again, you know, this is not, I don't know this as a kid growing up. What I do know as a kid growing up is that my father and I have a very tense relationship, and I'm not sure what that's about. And it just seems very natural to me. But in long hindsight, my father had a full scholarship to Cheney State that he gave up. And to him, and in thinking about the way he had always told the story, was that this was a kind of a sacrifice on his part for me and for the family, and, you know, and he was doing his kind of chivalric, do exactly right.
Right. I'm beating my chest, you can't see that, but yes.
Right, yeah. And over time, I you know, putting pieces together and just the snippets of things that he would say, I began to understand that, well, for example, before he died, just a few years ago in 2016, earlier than that, around 2011, 2012 or so, he was very sick. He was dying of diabetes. And I told him, I was trying to convince him to work out, to, you know, try and regain some semblance of health. And his response to me, it wasn't 2011, it must have been around the time of the prize, of course, because his response to me was, "What does it matter? I'm never going to win a Pulitzer Prize."
Whoa.
So clearly, his whole, you know, sort of orientation was toward me. And he took a lot of pride in my brother's success, right? That's a whole different,
different
category of conversation. But yeah, his relationship to me and my success was more competitive than paternal.
Right, I can see. And you talk a lot about you talk about how your father had this very academically rigorous vibe going on at home. You described that he would have you sit down with a dictionary and look up definitions of words he gave you until he was sure you knew them.
All the words in the definition. So I would have to explain the definition, and he would say, "Okay, well then, what does this mean? You use this word. What does that mean?" And I had to keep going until I remember I describe it in the book as heaving. He had his huge dictionary, is heaving the pages of the dictionary like the size of car mats that they seemed to me at the time. I obviously the long-term effect of that is I developed a love of language and a fascination with etymologies and, you know, the connection, the relationship between words and
as a child, how did that shape your feelings about learning or about teachers or scholarship? I mean, did you have migraines?
You know, oddly, no. You would think, right? But I think, oddly, looking back, I think that was how I identified with my dad. That's how I got his attention, right? And I had his full attention, and it felt like love at the, you know, and this was... So when I go to the dictionary, you know, there's a kind of otherworldly connection, right?
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah, yeah. So in that way, you did feel, because you said you can only remember a couple of times when your father told you he loved you, or you really felt that, and that was one of the connections you had.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh man. You know, in the book, you talk a lot about your relationship with your father. In fact, I mean, I wonder if the air traffic controllers hadn't been fired, if that change hadn't happened, do you think this book would have happened?
That's a great question. That was such a pivotal moment in both of our lives. You know, probably not, because I think my life story, the narrative of my life would probably have gone much more in a much more conventional manner, right? So we would have had stable finances, and I would have gone off to college in a much more secure manner. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have dropped out as I ended up doing. And
we're gonna talk about that.
We'll talk
too.
About that. Yeah, yeah. And I would have been more certain about my place in the world, right? The story I was meant to pursue or to play out.
Way more conventional and
much
middle
more
class.
Conventional,
you were
exactly.
a family of achieving Black people.
Exactly.
You know, it was going
upwardly
a different way.
Mobile, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You'd spoken a little bit about your brother, Robbie. Can you tell us a little about him?
Yeah, so Robbie, much like me, but perhaps to a greater extent, was ADD, and we were, you know, I was diagnosed as hyperactive. I think this is before the...
That's what they used to call
ADD. That's what they used to call us. That's right. Yeah, yeah. And so he was on Ritalin, and, you know, and my mother was very active in trying to find safe spaces for him, because she was extremely aware of how, quote-unquote, problem Black boys in a classroom, you know, what happens to them. There isn't a kind of environment of empathy and care and support, right? And so he could very easily end up in a very bad place.
Absolutely.
My mother,
still happens.
That's still very much the case, yeah. So my mother was very attentive to his education, and when he started to show some musical talent, she got him involved in the Settlement Theater in Philadelphia, Settlement Music School, rather. He did all kinds of extracurricular activities around theater and art and music, and he played a number of instruments, and so she just kept him active in that way.
Right.
Because at school he had trouble focusing in school, in the academics, right? So she kept him pursuing his strengths.
And you were pretty rebellious in school yourself, were you not?
I was much less, I was rebellious in a resentful way.
Tell me about it. Resentful boy.
Yeah,
oh.
Yeah. Well, I guess, so the town I grew up in, Willingboro, New Jersey, was a Levitt town, one of the three Levitt towns, right?
Oh.
So there's one on Long Island, there was the one in Pennsylvania, and Willingboro was the third full-scale Levitt town.
These were the
right?
towns that were built post-World War II
for returning veterans, exactly, with federal funds supported, right, and were curiously... prohibited Blacks and at one point Jews from moving in.
Interesting. And that was on the leases, on the deeds of the homes, yeah. If I recall.
That's
yes,
right.
Please go on.
Yeah, so in Willingboro was a majority white town when we moved in. And the town changed dramatically over the course of my life, my childhood. And I think my relationship to, and you know, so a lot of what I'm doing in the book is trying to use myself as a case study for ambition, for upward mobility, and how upward mobility and ambition intersect with Black masculinity.
Mm.
Which is can be a precarious, right?
Yes.
And in times dangerous, as history has proven, combination. And so one of the things that I really thinking about is puberty, right? And so we have the air traffic control strike when I'm 12, turning 13.
Right.
We have this changing social environment in Willingboro, in the town where I'm growing up. So I am feeling alienated from my sort of social sphere, right? Because I've grown up sort of acclimated to a white community, and I am now adjusting to my black friends,
right.
and my black identity.
Two worlds colliding.
And my parents not having had any of that experience, you know, just didn't think there was anything going on. And certainly me as a kid, I didn't know anything of what I was actually experiencing.
You were just going through it.
I was just going through it. Whatever it was is what it was. And so there were all these changes going on in the environment. And yeah, and I'm trying to reconcile. Well, the other thing, class was another big issue, right? And so we go from this upwardly mobile middle class family with the in-ground pool, and we literally had a picket fence around the house. And my father loses his job, and overnight we are, you know, destitute, right? So, I'm resenting all of these changes and not knowing how to deal with them, and it started to show up in my grades.
Okay, I'm hanging on the edge of my seat. Okay. We've got to take a quick break. I've been chatting with Gregory Pardlow about his book, Air Traffic. We're going to take a quick break, like I said, and we'll have more with Greg on the other side. This is All of It on WNYC. Welcome back to All of It on WNYC. I'm Nancy Giles, in for Allison Stewart. Pulitzer Prize winning poet Gregory Pardlow is in studio, and we're talking about his book, Air Traffic, a memoir of ambition and manhood in America. There is so much to unpack here.
Yeah.
It's not even funny. I mean, you talk extensively about the relationship with your father. I'm curious a little bit. You talked about your mom's involvement with your brother, but where did your mom fit into this scenario? Talk a little about that.
So actually, this is, I want to return to this whole area in a future book, so I've kind of not skirted around the issue, but I haven't gone as deeply into my mother and her role in the family as I want to. But the crux of it is, you know, after the strike, my father obviously loses his job. My mother turns on the charm, the magic, and, you know, the reason we maintained was that she, with her, she started her own business. She was an artist, a commercial artist, and so she opened her own commercial art firm, and picked up another number of jobs, and just her ingenuity and industry just kept everything moving. And so I really want to do justice to that effort, and I'm thinking about just her her use of art as a way of rescuing the family.
She saved you. It sounds like she saved you guys, because
absolutely,
she's now, all these skills are sort of burgeoning on her side. And talk about what was going on with your father on the other side.
So on the other side, my father now is you know, he worked as an air traffic controller for a decade, solid decade or more.
It's a stressful job.
Stressful job. His identity was all in it. That was his thing. That's what he was. And having lost that job, he now has to reimagine who he is. He has to tell himself new stories. He has to come up with new narratives. And though the reality is, he has to take part-time jobs. He's scrambling in a number of ways that are antithetical to his self-image. And I didn't know it at the time. Again, you know, and this is in long hindsight, I can see how his drug use increased from, you know, beginning back then. He had always been a weed smoker.
Okay.
Right? He'd always...
This was back in college days, even.
Well,
yeah.
He didn't go to college, but
when he first met, that's right. He bypassed college when he met your mom. Okay.
Yep.
High school is when he met your mom.
Yeah,
got it.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So he'd always had that as his alternative to, you know, the martini when he comes home kind of thing. But after he lost his job, you know, and we see it happening around us today. People lose hope and are disillusioned about the future. And so this is the way he began to self-medicate. And so my mother is holding down the fort in, you know, with this as a backdrop.
Right.
And, again, you know, not to my knowledge at the time, but and he gets increasingly worse. But it takes another 20 years before, you know, he's sort of well, at least until his addiction becomes abundantly apparent to everyone.
I mean, as you're saying, his work as an air traffic controller, that sort of, that defined who he was. I mean, it defined
completely
how he parented and how he
kind of
ran the house.
That's right.
So if you can talk a little bit about that, how mm-hmm. he was while he was the air traffic controller, and then how that affected him after, what kind of parenting happened or not.
He's already, you know, and this is the thing, I love my father immensely and admire my father immensely. But it's absolutely true that my father was profoundly narcissistic. He was a deeply neurotic man, and you know, we have some models of what that looks like in the public eye today.
What are you talking about, Greg?
I don't know.
Okay.
Let's see. But so he has this job in which he is responsible. I mean, literally has people's lives in his hand, right? And at the tip of his tongue, as it were. And the pilots have to respond directly with clarity and immediacy to his every direction. And he comes home, you know, he's got this little knucklehead, you know, 10-year-old son who's like, why do you want me to do that? What's that, Dad?
No, there's no time for whys.
He doesn't quite have patience for that, right? And I don't know, you know, I don't put it together that, you know, it's the stress of the job that, you know, and then, you know, you bring this air traffic controller home to this very domestic situation. And, you know, I guess another analogy is like soldiers coming home from war, right? How do you adapt day in and day out, over and over again, right? And switching gears so drastically from one hour to the next,
right?
Yeah. So the impact was profound. Yeah,
I can imagine. Yeah, yeah. Now you speak about soldiers and their adjustments. So I'm jumping around a little
sure.
bit. You enrolled in the Marines.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how did that come about? This is what time
in
the mix.
So when I left, I went off to college. I went to Rutgers straight out of high school. Again, thinking this is the story, right? This is what I'm supposed to do, right? This is all what my friends are doing.
Right.
And as the first person in my family to go to college, I really did not understand why I was there, why I should be there, what I was supposed to be doing. And so just a quick anecdote that I like to tell to give you some idea of how oblivious I was. I get I schedule my classes from 8 to 4 or something.
Okay.
It's already a bad idea, right?
Yes.
Monday through Friday, because it mirrored my schedule
in high school.
I thought that's what you're supposed to do. I show up for my first class on Monday morning at 8 a.m. and I go through my day. And at the end of the day, I go back to the same class that I went to at the beginning of the day at 8 a.m. because I thought that was my homeroom.
Oh my gosh, are you kidding me? No, there's no homeroom in
college.
There's
no homeroom in college, Greg. And I sat in that room by myself waiting for everyone to show up so that I could be dismissed from class.
Oh, for Pete's sake.
For Pete's sake, really. So this is how oblivious, you know, and people, I try and impress upon people what it means to be the first in your family to go to college, right? And the lack of resources is real, right? It has profound impact on one's experience.
And you don't know what you don't know.
You don't know what you don't know, really. So I'm at school and I'm trying to figure out and I'm just digging myself deeper into distraction. And I was smoking weed at the time. That kid. I tell you. So by the end of the first semester, and I tell my students this all the time, my GPA, my first semester, was a 0.75.
Oh, I don't mean to laugh.
We can laugh about it now.
At the time,
it was not funny
old.
At the time, let me tell you. So yeah, my father said, rightfully so, as you would imagine, I'm not investing in this. We're not putting another dime to this. And so I dropped out. And to what do? To get him back? I think it was in the back of my head. I was thinking, you know, well, this will show you.
This was, again, connected to your dad.
Certainly, right, yeah, right. Yeah. I had a friend who had joined from high school who had joined the Marine Corps, and he was home doing recruiting duty. And he said, you want to come in? You got nothing else to do. So I said, sure. And I thought, well, this is the ticket. This is the solution. So I ran off to Paris Island.
How in the heck did that change you or change things?
It was, you know, again, in retrospect, it was the best thing I could possibly have done in my life at the time, because I had zero discipline. I had zero direction. I had no firm narrative, right? I keep saying this. I had no story of who I was and what I was supposed to be in the world. And the Marine Corps gave me a grid. It gave me a way to approach life. And it gave me the discipline to actually see something through, see an idea through, to have a goal and to pursue it. So I was only in the Marine Corps Reserve. And you know, even with the great job that the Marine Corps did in sort of fixing me as a person, mm-hmm. it could only do so much, right? And so I was still nonetheless they have very colorful names for the kind of person I was.
What kind of names did they give you? What kind of names did they put to that?
There's a S-Bird was one. Yes, that's right.
Okay.
That was one of the colorful names. But that's so I wanted very much to go back to college, and I wanted the Marine Corps to pay for my college, and I became resentful, and I didn't know how to engage with the larger bureaucracy of the and systems, and so I became resentful, and I went back to my old habits of, you know, you blow it up, you know, what else do you do?
Right.
And so I got myself kicked out of the Marine Corps.
It's Well, what's interesting, I mean, you're talking very honestly about your own issues and addictions mm-hmm. and whatnot, which in some ways mirror your dad's. And God,
absolutely.
There's so much more to talk about in this book. But let's just jump ahead. You're a parent yourself now,
yeah.
And you're living in an area that's changed in many ways, in many similar ways, but opposite ways of the way when you were growing up. How have your experiences, what you lived through, influenced how you parent and how you see your kids? Basically, are you yelling at your daughters now saying you have to learn these words in the dictionary or daddy's not going to feed you?
I tried it. My wife won't let me get away with it. And frankly, the kids won't let me get away with it either. I don't have the backbone that my father had. You know, it's like, I say, sit down, you're going to do this. He's like, really? Do I have to? All right. No,
okay, forget it.
All right, forget it. Let's go have some ice cream.
Right. What is it like for you being a dad, having had a dad?
Yeah, I am incredibly indulgent with my kids. I love my daughters to excess. Mm. And I mean, we're struggling now. Struggling is definitely not the word, you know. So I teach largely because I've always been fascinated with the faults, the problems with education, and how I desperately want to give to others the information that I realize I lacked in going to college. So I became a college professor. I parent very much in that same way, and that's very reflective and thinking about what kinds of my father would be rolling his eyes with at my approach to parenting, which is, you know, let's sit down and have a conversation. What
right.
do you what do you think? How do you think we should handle this? My father would never have
none of that.
No,
oh
no, no, no.
Man.
But so my 14-year-old now, coincidentally, you know, we were sitting by the computer yesterday, waiting for the public schools to announce what people got into.
Oh, that happened yesterday.
Yesterday was the big day.
How'd she do?
Yeah. Well, she got into a couple of schools that she wanted to get into. But we're still debating. We'll see.
Right. Still navigating all of that.
Still navigating.
Well, it's fascinating. There's so much more in this book. We just touched on race. I mean, your family was on the show Intervention. There's like way, way, way more to talk about. But this has been such a pleasure speaking with Pulitzer Prize winning poet. And you're a poet. You started out as a poet.
Right.
So your dad's wordsmithing really helped you. Poet and author of Air Traffic, a memoir of ambition and manhood in America, now available in paperback. Gregory Pardlow, thank you so much for spending some time here with us.
Oh, it's been a blast. I appreciate it.
And we'll be back.